Chapter 13, Fulbright Global Scholar Award. Quote by Ivy, National Service Worker. Lauren, name tags are not common in Ghana. Photo description, girl running on guide wire at Camp Abilities in Ghana. In the fall of 2018, I applied for a Fulbright Global Scholar Award from the U.S. government. The scholarship is awarded for a 2- or 3-country research or teaching project that promotes collaboration with professors and communities around the world. I had several long discussions with the Fulbright office to learn how I might tie the goals of the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs initiative to my dream of promoting sports camps for children with visual impairments. The Fulbright is an extremely competitive program, and the chances of being awarded a scholarship were slim, but my wife Katrina encouraged me to apply because it offered such enormous potential as a sabbatical project, one in which she could join me if she were also granted a sabbatical in the fall of 2019. Katrina, who teaches at St. John Fisher University, has a PhD in special education and a degree in disability studies, so it would be wonderful to have her join me on our joint sabbatical semester. I needed 6 letters from various professionals, a 10-page curriculum vitae, and a 10-page proposal letter. I had to fill out numerous forms, including a budget. The application process was extremely time-consuming and nerve-wracking, especially after a sponsor for one country backed out at the last minute and I had to find another one. It helped a lot that I had solid relationships with professors and programs in each country I wanted to visit. I was supposed to hear whether I received the award in January of 2019, but due to a government shutdown, the announcement was postponed until March. Finally, in mid-March, I received the email. I was awarded the scholarship. Katrina and I would be going to Ghana with a side trip to South Africa while we were there, Ireland, and Brazil. Ghana. After a trip of over 5,000 miles, we arrived in Accra on August 9, 2019. What we noticed first was the humid heat, a wet blanket we carried with us everywhere. The next thing we noticed was the traffic. It was unlike any city in America. The roads are narrow, the horns are loud. Motorcycles weave in and out between cars, barely missing bumpers. People walk or bike from car to car, selling you anything you could ever need, including gum, pop, snacks, hard-boiled eggs, car floor mats, stuffed animals, housewares, among other items. One man was even selling a dead fish that must have weighed 20 pounds. It was a Ghana-style drive-through. I knew right away we were in for an adventure. Ghana has a larger percentage than the United States of school-age children who are blind, visually impaired, or deafblind because certain preventions and treatments are not as widely available there. Unlike children who are visually impaired in the United States, these children are generally not included in local schools and sport programs. My goal was to teach the Ghanaians how to organize and run a Camp Abilities, but the first challenge I encountered was that Ghana does not have a camp culture. Going to camp is an unknown concept. This meant convincing the schools, parents, and teachers that Camp Abilities would be a life-changing experience and that the added stress of getting their children to our program would be worth the effort. Ultimately, we hosted mainly day camps, where the only children who stayed on campus in dorms were the children who lived too far away to travel back and forth. Where are the kids? I was excited to begin work with Dr. Reggie Okanzi at the University of Ghana to host a Camp Abilities on August 26th to 30th. Reggie had been a professor with me in the physical education department at SUNY Brockport until 2007, when he retired from teaching in the United States and returned to his native Ghana to be a professor and administrator at the University of Ghana. He had gained an international reputation as an expert in physical education pedagogy. Selecting a date is easy. Running a camp is not. We had 2 weeks to fine-tune everything. But when I stepped off the plane, I discovered that, in fact, nothing had been planned or organized at all. No facilities, no coaches, no meals. There was simply no precedent for what I was attempting in Ghana, and therefore no real knowledge of what had to be done. At this point, we didn't even know where the kids were located. Ghana has several schools for children with intellectual disabilities and the deaf. However, only three are dedicated to the educational and social needs of children who are blind. None of these children were near Accra and the University of Ghana where camp was being held. I was in a foreign country within a different culture. I had no phone and limited resources. The Camp Abilities motto is "Believe you can achieve." I embraced that motto. The previous September, I had spoken at a conference at the University of Ghana, so I knew the campus and some of the faculty. I had also met Atumfor, a 30-year-old man who owned a physical education business that brought physical education to schools and taught exercise classes in the community. He was very dynamic and clearly a go-getter. When I shared my dream of starting a Camp Abilities in Ghana, he said, "I want to help you." Now it was time to work with Reggie and Atumfor against the odds to make my dream come true. Immediately, angels appeared. Four college students working full-time with Reggie to complete their national year of service, as required by the Ghanaian government. These four, along with several other national service students from the department, became our ever-present and ready helpers. Our first project was to comb the local schools to find children with visual impairments. Some faculty members at the University of Ghana had reason to believe that certain schools had students with visual impairments because children with other disabilities attended those schools. This turned out to be incorrect, but first we had to go on a wild goose chase, driving from school to school, visiting administrators and teachers. We spent hours with no luck. It was hot, and the traffic was difficult. We invited teachers to a training we were planning, but since the schools we visited had no children with visual impairments, the teachers declined. A brand new countrywide curriculum was being rolled out in the fall, so their time was already filled with mandatory trainings. We did know that there were a lot of children with visual impairments at the School for the Blind in Akrapong, about an hour's drive into the mountains from Accra. Along the way, in the small town of Mampong, was a school for the deaf, attended by some children who were deafblind. And so, on the day of a big curriculum meeting for staff members from all the schools in the area, we set out to meet with the headmasters of these two schools. We fought difficult traffic, then climbed 1,500 feet into the mountains on a two-lane road through small towns lined with shops, avoiding children running along the road and narrowly missing goats, chickens, and motorcycles weaving in and out of the cars. At last, we arrived at the meeting site, a girls' middle school near Akrapong, and were met by a joyous scene. Teachers dressed up in beautiful African dresses, singing and dancing together. The singing and dancing continued, interspersed throughout the day. I wish our school meetings at the start of the year were filled with such energy, spirit, and camaraderie. When we discussed our August camp dates, the headmaster for the School for the Blind became upset. The children were not in school at that time, and there would be no way to get them to the University of Ghana. I didn't realize how difficult transportation was for families in Ghana. So in addition to the camp we were planning at the University of Ghana, we decided to put on a two-day camp in Akrapong after school started in September. Since the field was being worked on at the School for the Blind, we would hold the camp at the School for the Deaf, and we would include five children there who are deafblind. This seemed to satisfy everyone. The next breakthrough came a couple of days later after Atumfor and I went on the radio to talk about what we hoped to accomplish with the camp. After leaving the station, we stopped by a small IT business next door where Atumfor worked on his website. As a white lady from the United States, I stood out everywhere I went, and we soon fell into conversation with an older gentleman in the store about why I was there and what we were doing. To our surprise, he said that he used to be in the field of visual impairment. He asked whether we had contacted Angela Afran from Perkins School for the Blind, who is now in charge of education for children who are blind in Africa. This was valuable new information. A few moments later, I was pacing back and forth in the small shopping area while on the phone with Angela, who was thrilled and said she would meet with us right away. We drove to her office at the Ghana Blind Union, an organization that provides services for people who are blind. While we waited for Angela, we met with the administrative staff, who were delighted with our camp plans. They committed to lending us equipment and some staff. When Angela arrived, she immediately whisked us away to meet her colleague, Belinda, who was in charge of education for children who are visually impaired or deaf in Ghana. Now we were really getting somewhere. Belinda advised us to meet with the director of special education in the country, so we all drove to the headquarters for education, walked up 4 flights of stairs, and met with the newly appointed director for more than 45 minutes. He had gone to college in Connecticut and taught in Missouri and Illinois, so he was happy to talk about the United States. He expressed support for our camp and invited us to a meeting the next day with the heads of every special school in the country to be held at the Akrapong School for the Blind. We were on cloud 9 after having made so much progress in one day, and Angela happily bought a Tumfer and me lunch. The next day, we drove up the windy mountain road through the small towns to the Akrapong School for the Blind. The heads of every special school in Ghana were there, maybe 30 people, all dressed in beautiful Ghanaian clothing. A talented chorus of children from the School for the Blind sang songs. Speeches followed, many about the importance of the new national curriculum. Then, one administrator spoke about the importance of inclusion, saying that the country would soon move to a more inclusive educational model and away from the current system that placed children with disabilities in special schools. Reggie and I clapped and yelled. Allowing children with disabilities to stay in their homes and attend local schools would help people in the community meet more people with disabilities and thus recognize their potential in education and in life. But we were the only ones cheering. The others in the room made their living by the current segregated system. Inclusion was a novel concept still in its infancy in Ghana. We spent the rest of the week sending out invitation letters to dignitaries, inviting people to our opening ceremonies on August 26th, calling Rotary Clubs and Lions Clubs, and getting equipment. We ended up recruiting children from the 3 schools for the blind, as well as coaches from the Ghanaian Paralympic Committee, the Ghana Blind Union, and the Ghana Blind Sports Association. At Tumfer, Reggie, the national service students, and I discussed the camp schedule, the meals, the shirts, which Tumfer generously provided us, the opening and closing ceremonies, and the media. In Ghana, it is customary to pay radio stations, TV stations, and the newspaper outlets to cover your story. We had to add this cost into our budget. I also emphasized that we needed name tags, as it is hard to teach a child who is blind if you can't say their name. You have to tap their shoulder or grab their arm so they know they are being addressed. This places a huge barrier in the flow of instruction and feedback. I made this point several times, and the others confirmed that they heard me. But as would soon become apparent, I still had much to learn about my own expectations and assumptions about a different country. Let the games begin. After 2 weeks of hard work sprinkled with miracles, camp was finally upon us. The kickoff event on Saturday was an adult goalball tournament with 5 teams, 3 men's and 2 women's from all over Ghana. It was hard for me to reconcile the fact that there were multiple goalball teams in Ghana with my assessment of the country's generally limited opportunities for people with visual impairment, especially children. The few schools for the blind that existed did not seem to set students up for success, above all because the ratio of students to teachers was too high, 20 to 1 versus 2 to 1 or even 1 to 1 in the United States. Presumably, the children who did succeed had strong family support and no other disabilities to begin with. I arrived at 9 a.m. and saw the teams waiting under a large tent. Also waiting nearby were some dignified adults in beautiful African clothes, dressed up as if they were going to a big event. It turned out they were physical education professors from the neighboring country, Burkina Faso, who had come to see the program and talk to Reggie. When I arrived, they were delighted to meet me and began an elaborate presentation of a big trophy to Reggie. I spoke with a few of the faculty and learned they felt a tremendous need for adapted physical education content and wanted to start a Camp Abilities. I gave them my contact information and then watched with some amazement as they all boarded a large coach bus that said Burkina Faso on the side, and off they went without seeing any of the actual camp activities. This was a very interesting interaction, and I was impressed that they drove so far as a group to see the University of Ghana program, even if it was a short visit. The goal ball players had been waiting patiently until this impromptu visit was over. The courts had been set up with lines and goals, but as the players got ready to play, we realized we had no ball. I had brought some donated playground balls to Ghana, and unfortunately, the well-meaning National Service students mistook the blue bell playground balls for blue goal balls, so they never ordered goal balls from the equipment room. It was Saturday. The equipment room was closed. Where were we going to get a goal ball? Ben, the goal ball coach and referee, lived over 30 minutes away by motorcycle. I was so sad and disappointed at this turn of events. Someone finally drove the half hour to the referee's house to procure a ball, and by 10:30, the tournament was underway. The level of competition and rivalry was intense. The hot sun did not deter great play and happy camaraderie. On Sunday, we took a break, and on Monday, we planned to hold hour-long opening ceremonies before beginning the staff training. By 9:30, we had an African drumming group. A large camp banner featuring a picture of me was hung outside the building. Attendees included administrators, professors, and members of the Ghana Blind Union, the Ghana Paralympic Committee, and the Ghana Blind Sports Association, as well as some students from the School for the Blind in Akrapong. The rest of our athletes would arrive the next day. Maya and Liz, two women from the Fulbright office in the American Embassy, also came to participate. Despite the joy and promise of the opening ceremonies, the day proved extremely difficult. During my run that morning, I had not felt very well. By the time Katrina and I arrived for the ceremonies, I felt like my stomach was going to explode. I got through Reggie's introduction of me and made it through my short speech thanking everyone and sharing our goals for the camp. But when Liz from the U.S. Embassy began talking about the importance of camp and the embassy's hope for diversity and inclusion, I could hold out no longer. I bolted to the bathroom to throw up. I managed to make it back for the end of Liz's talk and then speeches by a few more educational professionals. And when the ceremony was over, I weakly accompanied the others outside to take a photo under the banner before orientation began. I had prepared a PowerPoint presentation and set up my laptop that morning before everything started. When it was time to start the orientation after the opening ceremonies, I noticed my laptop was gone. Reggie's computer was gone too. They had been stolen from us while we were right there in the room. I was devastated. I had just started my Fulbright journey and could not imagine how to continue without a computer. The National Service students began trying to track the computers while I sat sick and paralyzed. Katrina saved the day with a flip chart and an hour-long program outline. We recruited the University of Ghana's Special Education Coordinator, Dr. Tina Nami, to help Katrina and me with the one-hour training. When it was my turn, I dug deep and swallowed to talk about potential, the importance of high expectations, tactile teaching, and some sports modifications. It took everything I had to engage the audience with no PowerPoint, no internet, and no visuals. After orientation, Atumfor took Katrina and me to a mall to buy a new computer. I really needed one, not only for my presentations for the rest of my Fulbright projects, but for all the grants and reports I still had to write, book revisions for two books, and multiple research papers I was co-authoring. I was sick at the unplanned expense, $2,700, and still sick from food poisoning. While the technician downloaded my files from the cloud, I lay down right on the floor of the Apple Store. Atumfor was a trooper. He stayed with us the whole time and then made sure we got home okay. As soon as we walked into our apartment, I threw up again. I hoped the next day would be better. Campers from near and far. Internet is intermittent at Ghana, so Ghanaians don't really rely on it. Thus, we had no electronic sign-up for either athletes or coaches. Atumfor believed we had 15 athletes coming and 10 coaches. On Tuesday morning, we waited eagerly for the athletes. 10 arrived from Accra, the eastern region, and other rural areas. Then a bus arrived from the city of Cape Coast, southwest of Accra, and out came 5 athletes and several coaches. I learned that one girl, Faustina, had bussed 4 hours the day before and then stayed overnight to join this group. They had all risen at 3:30 in the morning to catch the bus to camp. Nevertheless, the athletes were thrilled to be here to attend their first ever camp. In all, we did have 15 athletes and 10 coaches. The Cape Coast contingent stayed in campus housing, as it was too far for them to go home and back every day. As we prepared to start our sports program, I looked for the name tags. Oscar, one of the National Service students, said someone was getting them. I was impatient to start, but many names were unusual and hard for me to remember, so I felt stymied. The name tags someone finally brought hung on lanyards left over from a conference I had gone to the previous year. There was no space to write names on them, and lanyards around the neck were simply not safe for a sports camp. I was very upset. I could not do my best teaching if I didn't know the athletes' names. I pushed again for real name tags. At last, Ivy, a National Service worker, said to me, "Lauren, name tags are just not a common thing in Ghana." This had never occurred to me, and I had never imagined conducting a camp without a name tag for each athlete every day. We ended up writing the athletes' names on pieces of paper and taping them to their shirts. Eventually, the name tags peeled off, but by then I had learned many of the names. I will never again assume that every country has what we have. I will ask instead. We divided the athletes into two groups, one for soccer and the other for track and field, which included discus, shot put, javelin, jumping, and running with the various guiding techniques: tether, guide and blind runner holding a short rope, guide wire, human guide, blind runner holding the guide's elbow, and running independently toward a sound. Several of the athletes had never run before, and they clearly found it exhilarating. One athlete, whom we called Tall Emmanuel because we had two Emmanuels, had only started school at age 16, so this may have been why he hadn't run before. Others hadn't run because safe fields, roads, or sidewalks were inaccessible. Tracks were scarce where our athletes lived. In fact, no track was available to us at camp either, so we were unable to establish their mile time as we usually do. The athletes did all have soccer fields near their homes, so we timed them on a run of our soccer field's perimeter, and we timed their sprints across the field. When the runners reflected afterwards on their experiences, they all remembered their times and were enthusiastic about decreasing them when they got home. After track and soccer, we did goal ball on an outdoor volleyball court and also parachute activities, which the campers loved and requested for the next 2 days. In the afternoon, we did yoga and swimming. I was amazed how many of the athletes had never swum. The reason became clearer to me when I saw that none of the coaches wanted to help in the pool. Swimming is not a common activity in most of Ghana. I worked with 5 boys, 14 to 17 years old, all bigger than me, and I had 1 hour to get the concepts across. I began by swimming the crawl stroke and explaining it step by step while they felt the motions of my arms and legs. Once I had gone through the whole skill, I broke it down into parts. The boys lined up holding the wall and kicking their legs while I went around helping them. These guys were all muscle, so their bodies sank easily. I had them practice floating with partners, which was difficult due to their body density. There were a lot of laughs all around as they sank and the boys worked hard to stay afloat. The last activity was going underwater and holding our breath longer and longer, which was a great challenge the new swimmers took up with gusto. Yoga was taught by a student volunteer from SUNY Brockport. I had learned just before leaving on my Fulbright adventure that a group of students from my university were coming to study abroad in Ghana at the same time I would be there. This was a lucky coincidence. Alexandra, the Brockport student, did an excellent job describing the moves for each pose and leading partner exercises that the students loved. At Care to Share that day, every athlete described several things they had never done before. All of the stress and the barriers we had encountered over the past 2 weeks felt worth it. The next day, Wednesday, after more soccer and track and field, we had several elite athletes speak. And then we walked over to the dorms with the athletes for a 45-minute session of stretches, strengthening, and endurance activities they would be able to do with minimal equipment at home. I was excited to teach these home fitness activities to this motivated group. I had been telling everyone about the innovative and accessible approach I would be using. I picked up my backpack that had been sitting on the ground all day and strapped it onto my waist with the waist strap and clasp. I walked over to the dorm with a manual, short manual, using the human guide technique. While he told me about his dream of becoming a goal ball player on the Ghana national team. When we arrived, sweaty from the walk, I took off my backpack carrying snacks, water, and sunscreen, and felt a sting on my waist. I flinched and pulled out an ant. Then I felt a bite on my rear end, then one on my back. I brushed 2 more ants off my back. I looked down at my backpack and ants were all over the waistband, the top, and the entire inside bottom. Instead of preparing to lead the indoor exercise program, I found myself screaming in pain from the bites and cringing with horror at the pile of ants forming under my backpack. To my chagrin, the coaches laughed at me and got a kick out of my discomfort. This was something that happens often here, apparently. When I started feeling a sting in my crotch, I asked one of the other coaches to take over until I could sort things out. The Paralympic coach took over with calisthenics and jogging in place. The pain of the ants was equaled for me in that moment by the boring exercises he was putting the tired and hot kids through. I found a paper towel and killed all the ants in my backpack, leaving behind dead ants and smeared blood. I went to the bathroom and tried to get the rest of the ants off my body. For all I knew, there were more, sticking to my skin and maybe in my hair. This process of finding and killing the ants all over my body was stressful, time-consuming, and painful. Eventually, I returned to the exercise group determined. We did wall sits for time, planks both on the elbows and with straight arms, and side planks. We did forward and side lunges on both legs, squats, sit-ups, and wall push-ups. When the athletes started to tell me the number of seconds by which they were beating their times, I knew they understood the concept of achievement versus participation. And I understood that I needed to be more careful about leaving my backpack on the floor. The final day, Thursday, we did goalball and soccer, and then practiced the different guide techniques so the athletes could determine which they preferred. Most preferred running with no guide toward a sound. They loved the freedom and speed they could get running alone. This would not be possible in many places near their homes because of Ghana's uneven sidewalks, the large ubiquitous gutter system in place for the rainy season, cars, and general inconsistencies in terrain. But a soccer field would be a safe place to run freely, and now they had times to beat. We were fortunate to swim again and build on the skills from the first session. Several Brockport study abroad students came to help, which gave us a smaller ratio of athletes to coaches. I worked one-on-one with a young man named Abraham, who was 18 and had never swum. He used the kickboard for 5 feet, kicking using the wall for 30 seconds, floated for 10 seconds, and went underwater for 10 seconds. In a final push, he swam 5 feet using the crawl stroke and was thrilled. I didn't want swimming to come to an end, as that meant the end of camp. Closing ceremonies started with Care to Share. At Tumfor, lead hoots and hollers rang out for each athlete as they shared what they had accomplished. In addition to the athletes and coaches, there were faculty from the university, several local Lions, and 5 news stations. The closing ceremonies went on so long that it was too late for the Cape Coast athletes to go home on the bus. Reggie quickly found them 2 rooms at our hotel and paid for both. We gathered up the athletes and the physical education teacher who had brought them and took them all to dinner. The next morning, we gave them breakfast and sent them off on their long bus ride home. I had seen the impact of camp on these young athletes and sorely wished camp could have lasted longer than 3 days. Akrapong Campabilities. We had a second Campabilities to look forward to at the Akrapong School for the Blind. But first, Katrina and I took a week to go to South Africa to give some trainings on how to teach undergraduate and graduate students about inclusion and instruction for children with visual impairments. The trainings were held at Northwest University in Potchefstroom, near Johannesburg. Most amazing to me about the whole experience were the monkeys gamboling all over campus. The students hardly noticed them. They were so common. When Katrina and I returned to Accra, Atumfor and I got to work. We drove up the windy mountain road to the Akrapong school to meet with the headmaster, the physical education teacher, and a teacher who was visually impaired named Nina, who was also a member of the Ghana national goalball team. She would clearly be a wonderful asset to our camp, so we asked her to come and coach for the first day and give a presentation about her journey. She was thrilled. We had a long discussion about the schedule, the sports we would do, the number of athletes. We wanted 15, preferably between the ages of 6 and 12, and the number of staff the Akrapong school would provide. I had brought a suitcase full of clothes and some stuffed animals donated by the Brockport chapter of an organization called Dress a Girl Around the World. I gave the clothes to the headmaster to distribute, and we brought the stuffed animals to the first grade class. When we walked in, we saw small tables with 3 or 4 children sitting at each, for a total of 17 children who were blind or visually impaired. There was 1 teacher and what looked to be an aide. The aide was outside the door consoling a young boy having a meltdown. But it turned out the aide was actually the boy's mother, and the boy was melting down because this was his first day of school, ever. The teacher could hardly help, as she was responsible for all 17 children. The PE teacher, Ethel, told us this was not even the whole class. More children would come over the course of the week. I was stunned. The programs I have worked in have instructed a minimum of 6 students at a time, and commonly more like 3 or 4, with several paraeducators to help. How could one teacher teach upward of 20 first graders who are blind? When Ethel, Atumfor, and I handed out the stuffed animals, explaining each animal to its recipient, I was painfully aware that these children could use more than toys. I tried to focus on the idea that offering some level of comfort and happiness for any amount of time was a good thing. We next headed back in the direction of Accra and stopped at the School for the Deaf, where we were holding camp the next day. The school presented an initial appearance of disarray with large potholes in the driveway, clumps of grass in the yard, laundry lines everywhere, and old buildings. The school houses the students as well as a large portion of the staff and their families, so it is also usually crowded with people. But driving farther into the grounds, we could see a relatively even soccer field surrounded by tropical trees, and on a plateau above the soccer field was a basketball court. As we pulled in, 8 or 9 students came running up to the car, signing excitedly and asking us our names. Luckily, Ghanaian Sign Language is similar enough to American Sign Language that we could generally understand each other. The children were excited that I was from New York. They had a lot of time to talk because only a few of the school's 400-plus students had shown up for this first week, so classes were not being held. We met with the headmaster and some of the teachers who were going to help us. We agreed that they would bring 5 of their students who were deafblind to our camp, which was exciting for me because I know from experience that children who are deafblind tend to have limited opportunities for physical activity. The next day, we woke up early to catch the van and picked up the National Service students, Oscar, Emmanuel, Ivy, Roberta, and Victoria, on the way into the mountains. A great buzz of excitement filled the air as we pulled into the parking lot of the School for the Deaf and drove down the bumpy driveway. We parked the van and started bringing out the colorful balls, cones, field equipment, water, and snacks, and soon we were surrounded by children from the school who thought the activities were for them. Bored without classes or other organized activities, they jumped up and down asking us questions and followed us to the soccer field. It was difficult to explain that the program was not for them, but for children with blindness or visual impairment. Some of the students understood and ran off, but a few young ones who were new to the school and thus had little grasp of sign language could not comprehend what we were telling them. They hugged us and took the balls and started playing soccer. They were only able to understand once the athletes from the School for the Blind arrived. Since there were no trees nearby, it was a challenging endeavor to set up the guide wire for running on the soccer field. It took a lot of explaining to the staff and a lot of effort by 4 of us over the course of an hour to hammer a pole into the ground without a hammer. We finally got the guide wire stretched out tight just as the bus from the School for the Blind pulled up. Only Ethel, the PE teacher, and 1 other volunteer, William, an electrician, came to help. Luckily, we had the National Service students and the staff from the School for the Deaf. We also had name tags. Katrina had bought some in South Africa. It would be much easier to teach knowing the names of the athletes. In the shade of the hallway, we held a short opening ceremony introducing the athletes and staff and discussing the goals of camp abilities. Energy stoked. We began with goal ball and track. I taught the guide running techniques and marveled again at how the children love to run. Since the one field at the School for the Blind had been under construction for over a year, their opportunities to run had been limited or non-existent. I was very happy to see athletes who were deafblind working to reach their potential on each skill with the help of instruction and feedback from the deaf staff. For goal ball, the coaches tapped the shoulder on the side the ball was coming from since the children could not hear the bells. In between instructing the runners, I could see that all the athletes were getting the idea of rolling, blocking, and passing the ball. At snack time, Nina, the elite goal ball player, spoke to the students about how she discovered the sport and got more involved. She actually began playing at the School for the Blind, which had a team when she attended, and then continued to play in college. As she told the campers about the places she had traveled with her goalball team and how hard she had to train, she was inspiring, enthusiastic, and personable. Many of the athletes knew her as a teacher in their school, but did not know her whole story. Nina's talk was the perfect motivation for going into the afternoon sports. I had begun to notice dark smoke drifting towards us from a big fire in the palm trees just behind the school. In some places in Ghana, garbage management is intermittent, so many people just burn their garbage. As we began our afternoon session, the smell of rubber and plastic became overwhelming. I was feeling sick from the smoke, but we continued with yoga and five-a-side soccer. Just when I thought I could not take one more breath, it began to rain. The rain helped to dissipate the smoke, but unfortunately, we now had to stop our activities because of the rain. We sat under the hallway awning to wait it out. At last, the athletes from the School for the Blind needed to get back for lunch, so we had to call it a day at 2 p.m. We did a very enjoyable round of Care to Share before they left. Many athletes described skills they had never accomplished before. Despite the terrible smoke and the rain, I felt good about the day. I felt bad, though, for the deaf students who could only look on while we held a sports camp for their neighboring school. I wish I could have worked with them, too. On the second day, we started with the yoga and soccer that had been cut short by rain the day before. As I worked with the older group on yoga, I also taught them strength exercises they could do at home, squats, plank, sit-ups, and lunges. I loved seeing the athletes challenge themselves to hold poses and positions for long periods of time. An important component of this session was their personal reflections on how and when they could use these skills. After a snack break, I was again in charge of running, which was made more challenging not only by the heat, but by the fact that some deaf students had taken the carabiner from the guide rope, so we could no longer use that technique. As I explained the other running techniques, the younger students registered some confusion. Since they spoke Twi, pronounced tree, as their first language, I asked Atumfor to teach in Twi so they would understand. Unfortunately, this precluded my interpreting for the deaf staff since I don't speak Twi. It was a problem I had never thought about. Atumfor, ever the problem solver, went back and forth between Twi and English so I could interpret for the deaf coaches. Displaying great motivation and determination, the athletes got faster and faster at running with a human guide, tether running, and running independently to a sound. Rain started to fall, and we had to wait under the hall awning again. I was worried we would get rained out, but soon the rain stopped, and we witnessed a beautiful, complete rainbow over the tropical trees. Today there was no smoke. We explained the rainbow we were seeing to the athletes, and they were as excited as we were. Some of the deaf school workers helped us by taking squeegees to the basketball court to dry it for goalball, and off went the younger group, ages 6 to 9, to play goalball. Despite the children's limited experience with team sports, a real vibe of competitiveness emanated from this group. I was busy teaching the guide running on the lower field when I heard loud banter on the basketball plateau above. Suddenly, elated cheers rang out from above. When I looked up, I saw three little athletes with their blindfolds still on, arms above their heads, screaming and jumping for joy. They had scored a goal, their first ever in their short lives, and they exuded sheer delight in this immersion into the sports world. They were experiencing a feeling they had never had before, but now wanted to have over and over again. The feeling of competition and achievement. It was clear, natural, and honest, and I had to hold back tears of happiness on this last day of Camp Abilities in Africa. The older group then came to play goalball, leading to a nail-biting game that even spurred rivalry between the National Service students on behalf of one team or the other. Everyone was excitedly chattering when it was over. The deaf school staff loved the competition and encouraged the teams to stay and play against their students who are deafblind, who were just returning from lunch. We allowed the deafblind team to play with no blindfolds and rely on shoulder taps on the side where the ball was coming. I was impressed with how well they played, including scoring several goals. Right at the end of the game, rain started to fall. We gathered for a closing ceremony and gave each athlete a certificate of achievement. Reggie also honored me and Katrina with very large, framed certificates of appreciation. Flying them home was a testament to our commitment to remember this incredible program. We also gave the School for the Blind bell balls, jump ropes, and mini goal balls. We hoped the sports would continue. After just 4 days back at home, Katrina and I set off for Ireland. Ghana is extremely hot and dry, whereas Ireland is cool and wet. Also, Ghana is new to the world of camp abilities, while Ireland has held a camp abilities every year since 2010. My goal in Ireland then was to expand our program and educate professionals on the possibilities for children who are blind or visually impaired. Ireland has strong government support for sports, including disability sports. But as in the United States, gaps in implementation persist. Even professionals working with the visually impaired, teachers, physical therapists, occupational therapists, and orientation and mobility specialists often lack training in adapted physical education and inclusivity in sports. I wanted to help bridge these gaps. Tralee. I had been to Ireland many times over the years and had a long-standing relationship with the CARA Center, an influential organization committed to increasing opportunities for physical activity for people with disabilities across Ireland. The CARA Center, CARA means friend in Irish, was founded in 2007 by Patrick Flanagan, a lecturer at the Institute of Technology Tralee. Pat imagined a world where his son, who uses an electric wheelchair, could participate in anything he desired. To ensure that every Irish person with a disability could access sports, the CARA Center pushed for government-funded sports inclusion disability officers, SIDOs. The program started with two, but has since grown to provide SIDOs for almost every county in Ireland, all working to increase the participation of people with disabilities in a variety of physical activities. Tralee is the capital of County Kerry and sits on the southwest coast of Ireland, just above the Dingle Peninsula. We were fortunate to stay in a small, charming house downtown near the 2-mile canal leading to the ocean. It was just a 30-minute walk to my sponsoring institute, IT Tralee, since renamed Munster Technological University, which boasts a strong adapted physical education program with a focus on outdoor learning. I first came to lecture at IT Tralee in 2005, and it was then that I met Tomás Aylward, who is well known internationally from promoting outdoor adventure for people with disabilities. He has inspired me ever since to learn and engage in this area that is dear to my heart. I was particularly excited to present at the European Outdoor Education Conference to be held at IT Tralee the first week I was there. First, though, I was scheduled to give a workshop for all of Ireland's sports inclusion disability officers. It was great to have everyone in the same place. Many of them had never met one another. I was surprised to learn that none of them knew about how to play goal ball. Vision Sports Ireland, a governmental organization that promotes fitness activities for people with visual impairments, did not see goal ball as a mainstream sport, so there was no Irish team. I was determined to teach the SIDOs enough so they would be comfortable introducing the sport in their own countries, so we spent quite a bit of time on goal ball. Afterward, we all went out to dinner, and I learned more about each SIDO's journey into disability sport. They all had one thing in common, a passion for ensuring that children with disabilities got to play sports. The next day, the European Outdoor Education Conference began with the theme, Diversity, equality, and inclusion in outdoor adventure. Perfect for this venue and this group. Over 200 people attended from more than 22 countries. My friend, Edwin Bormans, the director of Camp Abilities Finland, gave a dynamic, energetic keynote address. On that first day, I met some of the most influential people in the field. I also went to a powerful presentation by the directors of Camp Abilities in Ireland, including co-founders Ursula Barrett and Niamh Daffy. I knew that the Ireland camp was having a big impact, but hearing the stories and seeing the video filled me with pride and happiness. Many in the audience asked how they might get a Camp Abilities in their area. The next day, I was the keynote speaker. I focused on how to assess the impact of programming in outdoor adventure on independent living skills. This can be difficult as many recreation programs focus on participation rather than achievement. I emphasize that focusing on achievement sheds light on how successful people with disabilities can be with some adaptations and support. Some listeners seemed to take this to heart, and I answered many questions at the end of my address and then throughout the rest of the conference. On the Saturday after I arrived, Ursula encouraged me to run the park run in Tralee Town Park, famous for its rose garden. Park runs are free 5K runs held all over the world in much the same way. Runners receive personal barcodes that track the number of park runs completed, times, place among finishers, and ways to improve. When I arrived at the park, I met friends from the Kara Center IT Tralee who introduced me to Ross, an athlete from the first ever Ireland Camp Abilities. He shared with me that he had developed a passion for running while he attended Camp Abilities and that the park run would be his 43rd. When he told me he was planning on running the Dublin Marathon in 2 weeks, I choked up. I often visualize the power of Camp Abilities expanding quietly in ripples, but this young man represented a wave-crushing stereotype of what people who are blind could do. I am proud to call Ross a friend now, and can't wait to see where his running takes him. At the time of this book's publication, he had completed over 200 park runs and many marathons and half marathons. Evaluating inclusion. Next up was a trip to Dublin, where I was to give a presentation at the National Council for the Blind of Ireland. I arrived to find about 20 people who were teachers of the visually impaired, physical therapists, occupational therapists, and orientation and mobility specialists. They were very enthusiastic about the topic of physical activity for children with visual impairments, as the information in their professional training thus far had been sparse. When I shared my research on college goalball teams, a man from Vision Sports Ireland, who had a visual impairment himself, raised his hand and announced he did not support goalball because it was a blind sport. His view was that our children should be playing sighted sports and live in the sighted world. I shared my belief in self-determination and giving children with visual impairments the choice to decide for themselves. Not teaching goalball to any child in Ireland eliminates it as a choice for them to participate now or in the future, recreationally or competitively. The rest of the group appeared to agree with me. For a while, though, it was difficult to continue my presentation because this same man kept interrupting with his strongly held convictions. He had an interesting viewpoint, but I found it a shame that older adults were deciding on what youth with visual impairments could and could not play. Overall, the workshop went very well. I connected with people from organizations throughout Ireland. While in Dublin, I met a woman whose name I'd received from a colleague who ran the Tralee Park Run with me. Joan Ryan was an ophthalmologist conducting research on the accessibility of park runs for people with visual impairments. She shared with me her interviews with runners who are blind from all over Ireland, gathering information on what was working and what we needed to be done. We talked for more than 2 hours, and she pointed me to research articles, websites, and people shaking up the world of running with a visual impairment. I got the feeling that I would be presenting with her at conferences in the near future. I was asked to be on her dissertation committee focusing on the same topic and happily agreed. The next day, I was fortunate to visit the Annie Sullivan Center, a group home named after Helen Keller's teacher for adults who are deafblind. On a visit several years earlier, I had consulted with them about setting up a guide wire system on campus so residents could go out and walk anytime they chose. Now the guide wire system was installed, and I was impressed with the opportunities for walking outside independently. I gave a 60-minute presentation about instruction and assessment for people who are deafblind, which was followed by a wonderful discussion in which I shared further ideas and resources. I also met Alexis, an animated woman, deafblind from Usher syndrome. Alexis communicated using tactile sign, so I needed a quick review of the Irish alphabet. She would ask me a question, and the staff would voice what she said. Then I would answer with the signs I knew and ask the staff to feed me the ones I did not. We had a lively 30-minute conversation about her family, which she liked to do in her free time, how she had lost so much weight, and what her goals were for the future. I laughed when she asked if I knew Joe Biden or Joe Lieberman since I lived in New York State. I explained the Rochester area is 6 to 7 hours from New York City. The staff told me that Alexis's need to communicate with tactile sign severely limited the number of people she could talk to day to day. I only wish I could go back soon and take this smart, athletic woman out for a walk or a kayak. Leaving the Annie Sullivan Center, Katrina and I drove to the University of Limerick, where I had spent 5 weeks on sabbatical in 2011, teaching in the European Master's Program in Adapted Physical Activity, offered through the University of Leuven in Belgium. We felt lucky checking into the visiting professor apartments we had stayed in last time, beautifully located right next to the Shannon River. At this time of year, early fall, the path that runs for miles along the Shannon is lined with yellow trees that stand out brightly against the darkened, cloud-filled skies. The first presentation I gave was to the graduate students and faculty. I shared the accomplishments of SUNY Brockport's Institute on Movement Studies for Individuals with Visual Impairment or Deafblindness, IMSV, since 2011, the umbrella organization for camp abilities, graduate-level programs, grant-funded research, and the cultivation of student leadership at Brockport. I also described our recently completed Lieberman-Bryan Inclusion Rating Scale for Physical Education, LRSP, a validated tool for assessing how effectively a classroom environment supports access to the curriculum for all students, including those with disabilities. The LRSP can be used in teacher education or by practicing teachers to better understand and implement inclusivity. I fielded many questions after my talk and was pleased to note strong interest in testing the LRSP in Ireland. The next day, I presented in an undergraduate adapted physical education class offered by Dan Tyndall, an old colleague of mine from Oregon State University. There were 50 students there for a two-hour class, but all remained impressively focused on how to instruct children with visual impairment. Immediately after class, the students prepared for their weekly clinic known as iPlay. Dan started this program, similar to one we had run at OSU, during my last sabbatical, and it was nice to see how it had grown. Each undergraduate student is paired with a child with a disability from the community to work on motor skills, physical fitness, and swimming for 90 minutes. The kids absolutely loved the one-to-one attention and the challenge. I met one family who came early with a 9-year-old son, Kian, and a 7-year-old daughter, Aoife, both visually impaired due to a genetic disorder called aniridia. The father told me that the children loved to be active, but there was nothing for them in the community. Kian, busy with some trains he had brought, said he loved sports and would love to come to a camp abilities as long as he could bring his trains. He was a sweet boy with round, freckled cheeks and reddish-brown hair who knew every child who came in and said hello to each. He jumped up a few times to get water, greet a friend, or help his mother get another chair. I was sad to learn later that his family simply couldn't manage the drive to Tralee for camp. As the parents gathered, I was introduced to them one by one, and then we began a question and answer session. At first, people were quiet, so I asked everyone if their children were in general physical education or in separate physical education, and if they were satisfied with the situation. One by one, the parents shared their experiences. One parent was totally happy with her child's physical activity at school and in the community, but as more parents opened up, it became clear that many of the children were not totally included in their physical education classes. There were units that fully engaged them and units where they sat out on the side. One mother told me she was not even allowed to talk to the teacher's aide in her daughter's school, and in fact, she could not communicate with anyone without going through the principal. Her daughter, now in fourth grade, had met no new goals since kindergarten. This mother looked sad and defeated, her shoulders hunched and her head down. I felt the same way. How could I fix this pervasive systemic issue? And the situation was even worse when it came to community activities. Most of these families were from rural areas with few programs available. When they are told their child cannot be accommodated in horseback riding, swimming, or gymnastics, it is heartbreaking. I shared some textbooks and web resources, but I'm not sure I helped any of these parents. This brief encounter made me realize that I must work harder to get the word out to teachers and community recreation organizations about the ease of universally designing programs to include everyone. On Friday, back in Tralee, a meeting was scheduled for me with all of the staff from the physical education department. The topic, I found out, was a new student, Maeve, who is visually impaired. I had met Maeve the week before in the lobby of the physical education building. Tall, with long brown hair and a big smile, Maeve was upbeat, if a bit shy. I learned she was a Paralympic track runner and studying massage and aquatic therapy, water-based physical therapy. She had been resourceful enough to get guides, note takers, and peers to study with and was excited about her program. But apparently, the advisor from the Office for Students with Disabilities told the faculty not to invite Maeve to the meeting because without real knowledge of the goals of the program or the assessments and practical experiences required, she would not even know what she needed. I was not comfortable speaking for Maeve, so I invited her to the meeting. She was really nervous, but when everyone arrived, we sat in a circle and set a friendly and encouraging tone. When Maeve began sharing what was working in her classes, I could see the shoulders of the 7 female faculty involved slowly relax, and they soon leaned further toward in their seats to learn more. When it was their turn to discuss their concerns, the main topic was how to handle a practical exam. How would Maeve gain the visual information she needed in order to give feedback to a student or group of students in the gym or the pool? I explained our method at Brockport with a senior in adapted physical education named Lindsay, who was blind. Lindsay would tell the student the 2 or 3 elements of a skill she was looking for, and then a visual interpreter would relay to Lindsay observations on the student's performance of those specific elements. This ensured that only relevant information was relayed to Lindsay, and also showed that she knew what she was looking for and knew what optimal performance was. It took a few weeks, but Maeve set up the same situation. And then I received a long text from her. She was standing next to her visual interpreter, and she said what she was looking for in the student's performance. And then, nothing. The visual interpreter was somewhere else, having apparently forgotten what she was supposed to do. Another meeting was necessary for the visual interpreter to understand. Hiccups happen. But most importantly, Maeve was advocating for herself, and her professors were all on board with her teaching and assessment approach. Mini Camp Abilities in Port Leash. We held a 1-day Camp Abilities on a Tuesday in the town of Port Leash, in the Irish Midlands between Dublin and Limerick. The camp would include a workshop for students of adapted physical education. Aileen Ahern from the National Council for the Blind secured the facilities, reserved the gym, set up the training, and got t-shirts, snacks, equipment, and coaches for the day. I took the train from Tralee with Sean Poland, a senior in the Adapted Physical Education program who also happened to have a visual impairment. Sean was from Portlaoise, so he was looking forward to going home to see his family after helping with camp. The train ride passed quickly as Sean, a well-adjusted young man with a positive attitude towards his visual challenges, shared with me his history of Stargardt's disease and explained how he could still access most of his classes by large print, audiobooks, and sitting up front. He also took extended time on long exams so he could give his eyes a rest. I had never thought of that strategy. When we arrived, Aileen picked us up and took us to the hotel so I could check in and we could eat lunch. Then we went to the high school where we would host the camp, and I met a few of the staff, including two I already knew from the camp abilities near Tralee. When the workshop attendees came in, I was surprised to see they were all high school students. Had Aileen recruited high school students to help with the camp? As I met a few of them, I learned they were all enrolled in a physical activity elective class at a private high school. I was happy to see a group of high school students interested in what we do. They were very attentive in the two-hour orientation workshop. Camp began with a short opening ceremonies in which we introduced the 20 campers and 8 volunteers, and the athletes shared their hopes for the camp. We then divided the athletes into 3 groups for wrestling, shuffleboard, and goalball. I was in charge of goalball. We took some time to feel the court and the ball and then discuss the rules and good ball throwing form. I let them all play with no blindfolds as I wanted them to like the game, and I have noticed that the blindfold often turns kids off if it is used from the beginning. A girl named Claire, who came in with poor posture and hair hanging in her face, told us she did not play sports. I had asked her to just try this Paralympic sport of goalball to see if she liked it. As it turned out, she was a rock star in goalball. Her throws, dives, and teamwork were top-notch. Her face lit up with pride at my feedback during the game. When she was on the sidelines and one of the athletes needed a break, she jumped back in, continuing to encourage her peers during the points. She left that game with a new self-respect. A Polish elite wrestler ran the wrestling. He used a big therapy ball to teach the athletes how to fall. They just rolled over the ball and then off to get the concept. It was brilliant, very controlled, and the campers knew just how far the floor was. The kids took to it quickly with a lot of smiles and laughter. Shuffleboard was called scooch here. Players used a shuffleboard pole and pushed the round pucks close to a cone, much like the game of bocce. The women in charge, visually impaired, and the mother of 3 children with visual impairments, had a wonderful way of teaching and encouraging the athletes. Many of the kids tended to hit the puck, but for control, they needed to push it so it would glide near the cone. Red and black pucks contrasted well with the light yellow floor, and a sound at the cone assisted with direction. The kids jumped up and down when they got their puck close to the cone, which everyone did at some point of the game. We barely had time for guide running before the closing care to share, so we decided to do a group lesson rather than separate stations. I first introduced the tether system, and I asked a few athletes to come up and demonstrate. We emphasized the length of the tether and the importance of allowing your arms to swing. Then we introduced the guide wire technique, which involves a long rope pulled taut with a carabiner or a key ring around it attached to a short rope handle, and the athlete holds while sliding the ring down the rope. The taut rope is typically 30 to 50 yards long with a knot to signal when the runner is nearing the end of the rope. I first asked a boy named James to demonstrate since he was totally blind. He ran with pride as he had been to camp abilities before and knew the system. I was holding one end of the rope, and when James turned around and ran to me with a big, toothy grin and his head swaying back and forth, I felt like all the hard work and time spent setting up this day had been worth every minute. James's cousin, Kieran, raised his hand as he really wanted to try it as well. Kieran was younger and had not been to camp, so the learning curve was bigger, but he loved running and wanted to go again. After that, every athlete raised their hand to run on the guide wire. I was delighted to see these kids learning techniques that would enable them to be independent runners. At Care to Share, every child named at least two activities they were proud of and wanted to do again. The parents expressed deep gratitude, and every child left with a shirt, a water bottle, and great memories of new sports they could access. Universal Design. While in Ireland, I was finishing the first textbook on Universal Design for Learning, UDL, in physical education, co-authored with Katrina and two other colleagues, Michelle Grenier and Ali Bryan. UDL employs an array of instructional techniques and activities that enable learning and achievement for students with wide differences in their ability to hear, speak, move, read, write, and engage with peers. Central to Universal Design is that variations in equipment, instruction, and environment are provided for all students, not just those with disabilities, and that they are integrated into the curriculum from the beginning rather than provided as an afterthought. During the last leg of my Ireland Fulbright, conversations centered increasingly on Universal Design as a way to ensure access to all students, whatever their ability level or particular challenges. After the program in Portlaoise, I took the train to Dublin to do a two-day workshop at the Irish National Sports Campus. This campus is huge, with a large building devoted to just Special Olympics. They had enormous pools with diving boards, indoor tracks, gyms, tennis courts, fields and woods for cross-country racing, fields for archery, and a whole equestrian area with beautiful horses. It is Ireland, after all. The Olympic and Paralympic teams all train here, taking advantage of the wonderful dorm facility. On the first day, I spoke to a large group of directors of national governing bodies, NGB, the governing agencies under Sport Ireland, tasked with organizing and administering most sports nationwide. It is a different sports system than in the United States, which has no governmental entity overseeing all sports. The Kara Center, which has a large office on the campus, took charge of setting the meeting up, and the national directors of rugby, cycling, volleyball, swimming, badminton, gymnastics, fencing, and track and field were all there, among many others. I was very pleasantly surprised, not only that so many NGB directors were interested in universally designing their junior programs, but that they were also genuinely interested in including everyone in the community in their sports. We had some engaging discussions on how to set up their specific sports to include all children who want to try. They even helped each other with ideas. I was happy that the directors could come together this way, as they said there usually wasn't time. They were very appreciative of my visit and stayed to talk long after the session-ending group photo was taken. The next day, I taught a course on how to include children with visual impairments in sport and physical activity. In attendance were teachers, sport coaches, and some of the people who worked at the National Sports Campus. In the morning, I gave a presentation, and in the afternoon, we played goalball and blind soccer before practicing different guide running techniques. We went through an amazing amount of information in one day, but I left feeling everyone had learned a lot. During our final week in Ireland, Katrina and I were fortunate enough to go to the Capanella National Center for Outdoor Education and Training, the most recent location for Camp Abilities Ireland. This famous center in the mountains, an hour's drive from Tralee, offers kayaking, canoeing, stand-up paddleboarding, hiking, camping, climbing, and orienteering. The highly experienced staff welcomes school groups all day, every day, including weekends. I had the opportunity to meet staff members I had never met. They were excited to have us there. We were accompanying students from the IT Tralee class called Outdoor Adventure for Individuals with Disabilities, taught by the esteemed Tomas Aylward. They were doing a practice run for the next week when they would teach youth with developmental disabilities how to canoe, kayak, and stand up paddleboard. I had been to three classes with these students already, and it was a lot of fun to join them for this one. Tomas and the staff took out a variety of boats. We put outriggers on one of the kayaks and a beanbag chair for positioning on one of the canoes. We strapped a wheelchair to one of the stand-up paddleboards and attached two of the canoes to each other to ensure they would not tip. Each student had a chance to try each modification on the water. The lake was beautiful, surrounded by big hills, sheep fields, holly trees, and small waterfalls. I was in a whitewater kayak and went around helping students see the possibilities with each modification. Planning was particularly fun because they knew each participant who was coming the next week. We discussed the lesson plans and how we would universally design them to accommodate all participants. While we were there, a large school group of 11 and 12-year-olds came into the lake in kayaks, loud and excited. When they got out of their kayaks, they all jumped and splashed in the water in their wetsuits for about half an hour. I could empathize with their enthusiasm and excitement. This is how I feel when I am outside. On the Saturday before we left Ireland, the new director of the Irish Camp Abilities, K.T. O'Connor, picked us up in the morning and brought us back to Campanella so we could give a workshop for some of the Camp Abilities staff. 8 staff members attended on this quiet Saturday on their own free time, which impressed me as some lived quite a distance away. We went over guiding techniques, tactile teaching, whole part whole, pre-teaching where the child feels the whole kayak or bike or tent before starting the activity, and communication. We all hiked with different goggles that mimicked types of visual impairment. We tried various guiding techniques and discussed ways of asking a child what they need. We then discussed universally designed for learning. How could the staff prepare for any disability or ability that comes to their program? Several staff members expressed frustration that school and community groups often do not provide information ahead of time, so they don't know what disabilities they will need to accommodate. This, I told them, is the beauty of universal design. Every person who walks into the facility is included from the beginning. The concept of universal design was still new, even to these workshop participants, who are some of the most experienced and knowledgeable outdoor leaders in the country. Inspired, they asked for more articles, websites, and books on the topic. I felt very good about the program and what we had all accomplished. We learned a lot that day and are all better teachers because of it. After the workshop, KT took Katrina and me on a beautiful hike in some very green woods near Tralee, an appropriate end to our Fulbright visit to Ireland. Brazil. Brazil was the perfect location for the third and final leg of my 3-month Fulbright journey, as I had long-term relationships there and knew the country to have been an excellent infrastructure in adapted physical education. University programs are strong, and the government provides significant, steady funding for research, some of which I have been fortunate to collaborate in. I have also enjoyed several visits of half a year or more by Brazilian students and researchers who were paid by their government to teach and learn with me in Brockport. Some of those very students and researchers were now running the 2019 National Conference of Adapted Physical Education in the resort city of Maceió, and they had invited me to speak. It was gratifying to see the respect these former students now commanded from their peers in Brazil. I looked forward to meeting new teachers and graduate students from around the country, and also getting a little beach time. There was already one Camp Abilities in Brazil, run by Dr. Josele Souza and held at the State University of Santa Cruz, Universidade Estudial de Santa Cruz. Josele had spent a year studying with me in Brockport, and my first thought was to work with her for the Brazil portion of my Fulbright. But Josele convinced me that her university, in a rural area in the northeastern state of Bahia, was not well situated for an expansion of Camp Abilities. Not only would the location make it harder to attract campers, but language would present more of a barrier there as well. Instead, she encouraged me to work with Dr. Maria Luisa Tenora Alves at the State University of Campinas, Universidade Estadual de Campinas, about 50 miles north of the major city of São Paulo. This university, also known as Unicamp, boasts an impressive adapted physical education program and equally impressive sports facilities. With the help of Maria Luisa, Malu for short, Jocelyn and other colleagues from around Brazil and I planned a new camp abilities at Campinas. Program in San Carlos. First, though, Katrina and I had the good fortune of working together on a 3-day graduate course with our good friend and colleague, Dr. May Van Munster, at the Federal University of San Carlos, about 90 miles northwest of Campinas. May, along with her husband and son, had spent a year with me in Brockport, and we continued to collaborate over the years. The course was called Inclusion of Students with Sensory Impairments in Physical Education, and our first day was full of theory and practical ideas. We discovered that our students had a wealth of experience with children with other disabilities, but not much with children with sensory impairments. We went over tactile teaching methods, whole part whole teaching, pre-teaching, thoroughly reviewing a unit or activity before it is taught, task analysis, breaking a skill down into its component parts, and ways to determine progress. One of my best memories from that day was visiting the zoo on campus during the lunch break. I saw a variety of Brazilian animals that were new to me, capybara, three-toed sloth, lots of monkeys, a toucan, and an anteater. I had never seen a zoo on a university campus. What a nice outing to get to know the students better. On the second day, we hosted 3 5-year-olds who were blind for a morning of motor skills. We had planned all the stations the day before, and at 9 a.m., the children, who were adorable, arrived with their parents. I was first introduced to Natalia, who was totally blind and clung desperately to her mother, unwilling to let go long enough to try anything. May had warned me this would happen, but with much coaxing and clapping, we convinced Natalia to touch a vaulting box used in gymnastics. She was very afraid of the unfamiliar, so we gave her a goal to distract her from her fear, sliding a little way along the box. Allowing her to feel the space and realize it was safe with no barriers was a key to unlocking her confidence. Eventually, she saw how capable she was, left her mother's lap, and slid along the box with no assistance. Soon, we had her trying the guide wire and walking independently with a tether. Again, we had her focus on where she was going, which took her mind off fear and reluctance. She was stiff and frightened at first, but with cheering supporters and a proud mother, she said, "I can do this!" And she did. Later in the day, I found Natalia curled into a ball, sound asleep on the grass. She was no longer clinging to her mother. She would go home with a newfound confidence. Another child I met that day was Vinny, who loved tossing a ball. He couldn't see it. He couldn't chase it. He could only hear it. He tossed his ball over and over again, listening to the splat of rubber on the ground. The ball would be returned, and he would begin again. During our program, Vinny's mother was delighted to see him learning activities other than throwing the ball, so she agreed to bring him to our full camp abilities program in Campinas. He had never heard of going to camp and had only dreamed of playing baseball and soccer. This was something to look forward to in a couple of weeks. For us, it was now time to head to Maceió. Maceió. The National Adapted Physical Education Conference was certainly unlike any I'd been to before in Brazil. The city of Maceió was a glitzy vacation destination, something like Las Vegas or Atlantic City, surrounded by hot, sandy beaches where flashy, scantily clad people hung out for hours on end. That just wasn't me. Fortunately, I fit in at the conference itself. Most people knew who I was, and they also knew a lot about the U.S. adapted sports infrastructure and who the key players were, like the United States, Brazil's struggles to provide widespread accessibility to children in their school PE programs. Whether it's true or not, Brazilians believe the United States has more expertise, and so they continue to send APE students and professionals to learn from us, hence my Brockport visiting researchers. I gave an all-day pre-conference workshop about camp abilities and ways to include children with visual impairment in sports. This was attended by some college students, some teachers, and a few athletes with visual impairments. We did an overview of instructional strategies and how to start a Camp Abilities, all of which sparked lively discussions. The day was very hard to get through, though, because it was tremendously hot, and we could not turn on the fan because the attendees could not hear me over the noise. In my keynote address at the conference the next day, I talked about universal design. This was a new concept in Brazil, especially when applied to physical activity, so I grabbed their attention, even though my presentation was not in Portuguese. The conference drew educators and researchers from all over Brazil for valuable collaboration and conversation. I learned much about their interesting research on inclusion, disability sport, and the needs of youth with disabilities in more rural areas. Paralympic Festival. I really chose the best time to be in Brazil because I was able to attend the Paralympic Festival in São Paulo. São Paulo is 6 hours west of Rio de Janeiro and one of the wealthiest areas in Brazil. The festival, which involved more than 1,000 youth with disabilities, was a stunning display of Brazil's commitment to disability sports. Much of this stemmed from being host to the most recent Olympics and Paralympics. I was truly amazed at the scale of the event, the level of organization, and the amount of support the young athletes received. The event was hosted by the Brazilian Paralympic Committee, which would ultimately provide support and coaches for our Camp Abilities in Campinas. Sports clubs and programs from around the country brought teams of youth who had been training at their home clubs to compete on the national stage. The purpose was threefold. First, to provide an opportunity to compete with individuals with similar disabilities on a level playing field. Second, for the Paralympic Committee and specific sports organizers to scout up-and-coming athletes for their junior Paralympic program. And third, to assess each athlete on a variety of skills specific to their sport in order to determine future training needs. We have no equivalent program in the United States that I'm aware of. The level of competition I witnessed in blind soccer, goalball, running, swimming, judo, wheelchair basketball, table tennis, and more, and the number of children of all disabilities involved were a testament to Brazil's well-functioning Paralympic pipeline. In addition to tracks, pools, judo gyms, table tennis and basketball courts, soccer pitches, official goalball courts, and powerlifting facilities, the facility had an entire room dedicated to formal assessment. Athletes went to stations designed to measure their aptitude for various sports, after which they would be trained in those sports, transported to competitions, and assessed for their Paralympic potential. Brazil's dedication of funds to bring all the athletes to São Paulo for 3 days, money for flights, hotels, coaches, uniforms, athletic trainers, referees, and meals, communicated clearly to these young people, we value you. We value your achievement. Next event on the Fulbright calendar was Camp Abilities. Camp Abilities, Campinas. With the help of several friends throughout Brazil, Marli, Josle, May, and some of their students who flew in to help with the camp, some University of Campinas students, and the Brazilian Paralympic Committee, we assembled 15 coaches for 8 sports and 15 campers over 3 days. That meant 15 kids who ran and jumped, kicked, tumbled, and flew in the air above a trampoline. We did track and field, swimming, gymnastics, adventure activities, martial arts, goalball, soccer, and one of my favorites, tactile bingo. It was very hot, but we made it through with smiles all around. Vinny and his mother rode in our friend May's car to camp, where he proceeded to kick the beat ball, listen to its sound, and run with the winds. His laughter filled the air as he chased the beep and scored a goal. He gained so many skills that I felt I was witnessing a real transformation in the boy who had first participated in our program in San Carlos. But Vinny wasn't the only one learning new skills. I learned how to roller ski. Roller skiing is basically cross-country skiing without the snow. The skis are on wheels, and participants propel themselves with poles. The sport began as a way to practice skiing in the summer months, but soon became a worldwide competitive sport in its own right. I love skiing and love a challenge, so I climbed aboard, with my helmet, of course, and pushed off. The mechanics are similar to ice skating and rollerblading, in which you push off with one foot and glide on the other. In roller skiing, you have the added help of poles for balance and propulsion similar to cross-country skiing. It took at least 30 minutes for me to get a rhythm and learn to propel myself any distance. But once I got the hang of it, I could give better feedback to the athletes. Knowing how hard it was to get going gave me a better appreciation of the athlete's first success at roller skiing with speed and competence. In the months after this first Campinas camp, the COVID-19 pandemic shut down hopes for a repeat performance anytime soon. But I am hopeful that as conditions improve, the excitement will reignite and even more campers will be able to take advantage of their wonderful facility and the tremendous skills of my Brazilian educator colleagues. Piama, a highlight and a hope. Malu had put Piama on my schedule but hadn't told me what it was or who I would meet. She just said to be ready when my driver picked me up at my Campinas apartment. In under an hour, I was in the town of Jundiaí, pronounced Jundiaí, at what looked like a stadium. That stadium contained a dance studio, a track, gyms, tennis courts, basketball courts, a pool, and more. I soon discovered that this entire building was dedicated to providing sports to people of all ages in the community who had disabilities. And the programs did not end at the building's walls. A local park had facilities for biking, stand-up paddleboarding, kayaking, swimming, and walking. I had stumbled into a pocket of utopian access and been given only a couple of hours to see it all. I quickly made plans to come back for an entire day. Piama, Programa de Esportes y Actividad Motoras Adaptas, or Adapted Sports and Motor Activities Program, began in 1996, coincidentally the same year as Camp Abilities. Its founder was Denise Silva Neves, a graduate of the Campinas Adapted Physical Education Program, who started with a few inclusive sports and then expanded the offerings throughout town as interest and support grew. Residents seemed to take the disability access for granted, as if to say, well, of course we offer that. Piama's mission is my mission, providing equal access to sports activities and so to include people with disabilities by using sports as the tool. Equal access is at the heart of universal design, the concept increasingly important to me. The idea is that every person can access every opportunity with no barriers, physical, attitudinal, or systemic. Every building, bathroom, program, and class is designed to include every participant from the beginning. And here in Jundiaí, Brazil, was a model I hope to see replicated around the world. Piama offers around 15 activities, including rhythmic gymnastics, aquatic sports, and dance. The municipality provides paid staff, equipment, and space. There is never a fee. All of the coaches are full-time and work for Piama year-round. To date, Piama has served nearly 1,500 people with disabilities from Jundiaí and the surrounding region. What a testimony to the impact a community can have when it embraces everyone. I watched a dance group with two men in wheelchairs moving to Brazilian music like I had never seen. I saw an inclusive running group that had just come back from a 10K through the town, an inclusive soccer group, some inclusive tennis matches, and kayaking in a big public park. These programs happen every week, all year round. My favorite experience was a 12-mile community bike ride with a dozen others, some with various disabilities, through the beautiful city park. It was a beautiful conclusion to my stay in Brazil and to my Fulbright semester overall. The images of Piama continue to inspire my life goal of fostering universal design in sports. Mission complete or not? I completed my missions in Ghana, Ireland, and Brazil. Like the campers, I met wonderful people, overcame some interesting obstacles, and learned new skills. I saw Vinny and Natalia and so many others discover that when you believe, you can achieve. I hope I left a legacy of confidence and commitment in my wake. Camp Abilities is not meant to be a stopping point for our campers. We provide each child with an assessment and modifications for use at home and in their communities to continue to improve performance and demonstrate their abilities. Campers leave camp with goals. I, too, finished my Fulbright Global Scholar Award program with new lessons and new goals. One was to focus on developing and implementing culturally sensitive programs, meaning programs that provide sports and adaptations the athletes can take back to their communities and engage in seamlessly. For example, Ghana has few tracks but many soccer fields. Thus, teaching athletes to sprint across a soccer field and run its perimeter is more culturally relevant than teaching them to run 400 meters on a track. I also finished the Fulbright with fresh motivation to resolve the dichotomy I had always known existed in many places between inclusive supports in some sectors of society and marginalization and exclusion in others. The University of Ghana, for example, has a rich history of including students who are blind and visually impaired on campus. These students live predominantly in two dorms, and since each dorm on campus fields a team or two for the various intramural sports, the dorms with visually impaired students started goalball teams and challenged their peers to play them with blindfolds on. When I was there, 8 men's and 4 women's teams competed in intramural goalball tournaments, complete with uniforms, referees, and a large fan base. All students at the university knew what goalball was. But when these students were younger, the visually impaired children were segregated from their sighted peers and sent to separate schools that were not set up for success. Stepping off the university campus also meant seeing people who were blind begging in the streets and not given a place in society. In Brazil, despite the stellar Paralympic program, physical education teachers rarely knew how to include the children with disabilities in class. This is the gap we need to bridge. I will continue to work with my Brazilian colleagues on research and programs to help them train current and future teachers. Together, we can make a difference.